You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
The idea that technology could be self-deterministic, or guided by something other than individual human intervention, seems absurd. It seems like something out of science fiction. But that's exactly the proposal offered by today's guest. Kevin Kelly is the author of the new book, What Technology Wants. In this book, Kelly sets up a kind of radical proposal, an idea of a technological culture that exists both as part of and outside of human culture. One technology, say the mobile phone, could be considered an almost inevitable evolution from previous generations of communications devices. Think of it as an origin of species theory of technology. Kevin Kelly sat down with David Weinberger not long ago to talk about what technology wants.
Kevin Kelly, I want to actually not start with the most obvious line, but we'll get to it, which is this, using the word want in connection to technology. But I was actually, when I was reading just a wonderful, wonderful book, I found myself thinking about a line in a Bob Dylan song about his ex-wife Sarah, a very plaintive song, in which he rhymes help and kelp. And when I heard that song, I was so struck by, he was so intent on writing the song that he actually rhymed help and kelp. And in reading your book, at times I was struck by, you were so intent on doing something very, very large in your book that you were willing to use the word want in connection with technology, knowing that it was going to, every interview was going to start with that question, which we're only sort of backwards doing here. I'm wondering what the idea is that was so compelling to you that you were willing to rhyme help and kelp.
I think the origins of the book, and therefore the title, came from an absence in my life. And the absence was a framework, a theory of technology. So it appeared to me that technology was sort of becoming one thing after another, one gadget after another, one invention after another, just one thing after another. That is sort of unsatisfying. It's sort of like biology, where you just have a list of organisms. There's just, you know, there's just one creature after another. There's this feeling there has to be more. And so when, you know, in my life, both when I didn't have very much technology around me and then, you know, in my involvement with new technologies, it just felt to me that there had to be something more than just one thing after another. And in my search for some framework for understanding technology that was more than that, there was almost nothing. There was really no theory of technology. My interest was to, as a journalist, to go around and talk to all the smart people, philosophers, who had theories of technology, and I would go back and I would report on that. And after 5 years of reading everything, talking to everybody, I finally faced up to the fact that there was not a theory. And so I rhymed kelp and help out of desperation to actually propose a first draft for a theory of technology. The theory that it came up with is an extension of the other great theory that we have, which is Darwinian evolution. I think you hear the word want out of my view of Darwinian evolution, which I have to admit is a minority view.
It's a minority view within evolution theory.
Right.
You remain an evolutionist.
I'm an evolutionist. So the orthodoxy in evolutionary theory today is that there is no direction in evolution. And this is, there's some wonderful books, and the most vocal advocate of this was Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould, who basically say that any apparent directionality that we see in evolutionary development is something we project onto it, that it does not exist there and that inherently there is nothing.
So you look backwards and you see a path, but you're always going to, whatever path is there, you would see and think.
And his famous trope, if you rewind the tape of evolutionary life back to the beginning and play it again, you would get something entirely different. Now, that is the orthodoxy right now. However, there is a set of young and sometimes older evolutionary theorists who don't adhere to that, who say, in fact, actually, there are directions, there are trajectories, there are tilts, biases in this system. They go about showing evidence about why there would be. And I adhere to...
For example, as you point out in the book, sight, eyes have developed in multiple species multiple times as if this is what happens when, no matter how many times you rewind, you're going to end up with eyes.
Right. So that if you were to rewind life again, you would still get up eyes in many, many organisms. There are other ways to kind of see a drift or bias in evolutionary development, such as on average, do things become more complex? We can understand why at the leading edge things would become more complex, because if you're simple, you have no room, you have nowhere else to go but to become more complex. And so that doesn't really tell you anything. But at the trailing edge of life, in other words, once something becomes a little bit more complex, not the most complex thing, but it's a little bit more complex, does it ever become more simple? And the answer is rarely. Because if it was completely random, you would expect complex things to sometimes become simpler. But we don't see that on average. We see things on average becoming a little bit more complex, even at the bottom. And so what this begins to suggest to me is that there actually is a tilt, a bias in the evolutionary system. So when you hear the word what technology wants, you're hearing two things. You're hearing two heresies, so to speak. You're hearing the heresy that there actually is an extension of evolutionary theory into the technium. That's one. And the second heresy is that you're hearing this idea that evolution itself has a bias, which is not the orthodoxy right now.
And you just use the word technium, which you should perhaps explain.
The problem with technology is that it's both plural and singular. And we have, biotechnology, plastic technology, all these individual varieties of science. And we use it in that kind of a singular way. But I was interested in not the things that are in our pocket as individual artifacts, but the realization that, say your phone is made up and requires 1,000 different intermediate technologies, and that the idea is that these technologies are more like ecosystems that are codependent and interrelated with other supporting and intermediate technologies, each of which themselves may have 1,000 other ones supporting them. And so we could think of the kind of superorganism of all technologies as something in itself. And to distinguish that, I gave it the name the technium. The word technium, I think I want to convey the idea that it's not just a collection of inert achievements that we've made, but the fact that all these things form in some way a ecosystem, a superorganism that, like any system, exhibits two properties, which is that it has a property of the whole that is not present in any of the parts. And just as a beehive exhibits a behavior at the hive level, that behavior cannot be found in any of the individual bees, and that the behavior of the technium has a behavior that's not going to be found in your iPhone itself. And the second thing about those systems is that whatever system it is always has inherent biases. That's what I'm looking at. I'm saying if the technium of all these technologies are all interrelated and all codependent, it forms some kind of a system that has some leanings or biases in certain directions. What are the biases of the technium?
You're listening to Radio Berkman. In Kevin Kelly's new book, What Technology Wants, he proposes that technology has evolutionary underpinnings. David Weinberger asked Kevin whether he views this as a true scientific theory.
Evolutionary theory is a theory, right? And in talking about this, you just went back and forth between your thoughts, calling it a theory and a framework. A theory is supported by facts and gets argued and gets established or not. It's falsifiable. Living within technology, it feels like it's non-determinate and things just happen, the very thing that you found is satisfying. What's the status of your theory of technology? Is it a theory? Is it a paradigm? Is it evidence supported? What?
Yeah, it's a good question. So
it's a long question.
No, I mean, I think my theory is really closer to a proposal. I don't think it's in any way a scientific theory in the sense that I don't think I've offered a falsifiable prediction based on the theory, which is what you would really say, well, if this is true, then we should expect X and Y, and if we don't find X and Y, then that's not true. Or
we should find a fossil record
exactly,
of change
or something.
If it's evolution.
Right. And so there's, you know, both the theory of evolution and my theory, both are handicapped by the fact that we're talking about a case of one. That makes it very difficult to kind of do experiments because there's only one case of it. In this case, it's kind of maybe more of a hypothesis or a proposal rather than a falsifiable scientific theory.
So I read your book a little differently.
Okay.
I read it grander than a proposal or a hypothesis. Tell me if I'm far off. It seemed to me you were, in terms of science, you're something closer to a paradigm.
Okay.
Paradigms are not evidential, but they suddenly make sense of a whole set of things that had been outliers, right, in the classic sense of the Kuhnian sense of paradigm. And I thought, actually, when I was doing, I thought you were doing something bigger than a scientific paradigm. I thought you were trying to sort of turn our thinking inside out and change, in a sort of Copernican way, change our way. We think that technology is something that we make, and it consists of everything from computers to marshmallow air guns or whatever, you know, whatever we want to make. It's an open field. It has no direction except what we make. We're, you know, pretty much in charge of it, and we are the lead creatures in at least our part of the universe. Your book seems to me to say that that's the sort of geocentrism that we got past when we realized we're not actually the center of the universe, and that technology may be, as part of evolution, as part of a natural system, that may be larger than we are.
Yeah, I think I'm a big fan of metaphors, and I think maybe if what I've done is introduce a new metaphor, a metaphor for placing technology in the cosmos, and to kind of extend what you're saying, what the book attempts to do is actually to suggest that the roots of technology are actually not just in our imagination, but actually kind of reach further back through life and even further back into these persistent disequilibrial systems like galaxies and stars, and even further back to the Big Bang, that there's actually kind of a thread, a narrative arc of increasing self-organization that runs through the universe and through life, through the technium, and of course beyond us. And so, in that sense, it's kind of introducing a different grand story and saying that the technium is actually part of this larger grand cosmic evolution, and that it's much bigger than ourselves. And it's introducing that kind of metaphor into the world of saying, here is a larger narrative that this is part of, and that we can actually be part of when we make new things.
Would it be overstating it too badly to say that that we are the technium's way of manifesting itself?
It would not be overstating it too much. And I think that's important what you say, because what I want to reiterate is that we are part of the technium. I mean, humanity, and of course the 6 billion people alive individually are part of the technium. The technium is, while it has an increasing autonomy in itself, it's in a curious way, that autonomy includes us. And so it's impossible to unravel, just as it's impossible to unravel nature and nurture, the role of genes and the environment in our own makeup. Both are important. You cannot unravel which is which. The same thing in the technium. Humans are part of the technium. The things that we make are part of it. Both of them together create this new thing that has increasing autonomy in it. While it will increase its autonomy over time, we are always part of it. And this is the problem, not the problem, but this is the paradox of self-creation. We are self-created beings. We have made our own humanity. We have created us, we're changing our own biological beings through time, through our minds. That means that we're self-created. And when you're self-created, you have this built-in tension, because you are both the created and the creator. And we are both the creators of the technium, and we are both the thing that's created. And that tension, I think, is going to stay with us forever. In 1,000 years from now, when people are talking about technology, they will still be wrestling with the fact that we are both the masters of it and the slave to it. That we're both the created and the created. And I think that tension is inherent in what we have made.
And at the same time, the other part of me as I read your book, I'm going along all with this, with all this, and I was sort of nodding vigorously as I read and thinking, wow, that's really cool. And the other part of me is very worried about the future of the internet.
Right.
There's a sense in which, and it's just a sense, in which this book is maybe the epitome of techno-determinism. That technology has its own bias. It's going to happen one way or another. And yet at the same time, you know, a single act of our legislature could turn the internet into cable TV. You know, it could just poof, there it goes. It doesn't feel that deterministic, or if there's that much of a bias towards it, inevitable bias.
Sure. So I think, you know, inevitability, which is a word I use in the book, and I talk about how the large-scale progression of technology development is inevitable. And those inevitables are fighting words. I mean, you know, you can't let it pass without responding to it in some ways. And my vision, my sort of theory, my metaphor of how this works is that at the macro scale of a large scale organization, these things are inevitable in the way that we would say, you know, a tubular gut and four legs in an organism is inevitable. There's a certain amount of physics and the constraints of chemistry that will guide whatever animal is going to be made. Just the physics of it kind of require, you know, four legs are stable and you have tubular guts, and there's lots of chemistry reasons why that wouldn't want to happen. And I think the same thing is going on at the technological level. But having said that, say, the internet would be inevitable, and the internet in the sense of, you know, maybe a binary electrical, a network of binary electrically charged communication connecting everything to everything, that's kind of inevitable. What's not inevitable are the kind of the speciation at the level of the species of this, or what I would call the expressions of the technology. So while it may be that even a flying bird, because we know the wings converged more than once, was inevitable, you know, the particular coloration and the feather shape, let's say, of a parrot was not inevitable. It was probably very surprising. I think an internet of some sort is inevitable on a planet, but not what kind of internet that would be made. And I think the expression of that, the more something is manifested into the particular, the more particular it is, the less inevitable it is. And I think that the decisions about the internet, like how open is it, how closed is it international, is it transnational, is it commercial, is it nonprofit, all these expressions of it are not inevitable, and we have a lot of choice in that. And those choices make a huge difference to us because they change the tenor, the character, the personality of these inevitable technologies.
So let's say it turns out in the next 10 years that and I'll switch from openness of the internet, because that's I think there's lots of argument about what openness would mean in one society versus another. But the internet as a universal connected, that feels to me more like being having a tubular gut. I mean, that's how networks progress, and they connect, and they all connect up. So let's say that in 10 years we continue on what seems to be our current trajectory, which is the rise of more and more internets, broken off pieces, especially around nation states, firewalls, better protection. Right now, that seems to be the trajectory. We started out everything connected, and now we seem to be building more and more secure walls in various parts of the world. If that turns out to be the direction in which we go, do you then say in 20 years, you look back and you say, I guess nation state-based internets, that's the tubular gut. That's the way it had to go. And if you do, then aren't you subject to Gould's complaint that you are looking backwards and saying what was had to be?
What I would say is the forms of technology that are inevitable are those that adhere to the kind of what I would call the macro trends in evolution, which is increasing diversity, increasing specialization, increasing mutualism, increasing energy density, etc. And we could look at this question of whether nation states or the you know kind of regional or I don't know what it calls kind of cellular types of the internet, whether they were in line with those other general trends or not. And I haven't gone through that process, but we could do that. And I would suspect we have one life, but we have multiple organisms and cellular organisms, and whether the question of is one single large planetary network more evolutionary or more biological than having cellular ones? That's a question we can actually try and look at and tease apart to see whether or not it is. And because I don't know just on without thinking about it whether it is or not. And I think by extending, in other words, saying if this was an extension of natural evolution, is there any kind of biases here that would tend towards one way or the other?
So it may turn out that an internet that consists of multiple separate cells of internets follows the evolutionary path, is the sort of specialization that one would expect, although it sure feels like a step backwards. From my point of view now, of course, in 100 years, I'll look back.
And then there's the question of whether if you had all these cellular organisms, whether there was a meta level of something that was actually more like a colony of cells forming kind of a superorganism. And so it may be that there's not kind of a flat global network. There is something more like a cellular global or multi-organism global network. And so I think that's worth doing, running through the exercise.
So you may have now a falsifiable prediction.
Yes.
Not now, but once you run through it.
Exactly. We could say, but that's what I'm suggesting. I don't think these inevitabilities are going to just pop up and that we can identify them. I think there's actually kind of a process that we would go through to try and look at these macro forms.
So I personally am very happy that we actually have gone this far in the conversation without talking about, what do you mean technology wants something? So now I want to ask you about wants in a different sense. It struck me, it's one of these Gestalt flips that happen sometimes when I was reading your title, What Technology Wants, and I suddenly read it wants in its prior sense of what it lacks, you know, for want of a nail. So in
that's
that
great.
Sense,
I didn't thought of that.
What does technology want? What does it lack that it wants from us to do for it? How can we serve our technology today?
How can I help you today?
Can I supersize that?
Yes, exactly. Actually, here's I'm going to answer this in a certain sense of saying, okay, if there is this sort of self-accelerating system of increasing autonomy in this thing that we've made as a system, and a way to say is like, what's it want from us? What's our role in this? Because it's obviously going to, you know, keep amplifying and accelerating whenever we do. And this is what Moore's Law is kind of about. It doesn't matter how much you, whether you want to go make it faster or slower, it's going to run a very unwavering curve. As we make these systems that are self-replicating, as we make technology that is more sort of autonomous, it needs from us a way to embed in it our desires, our influence, our own destiny. So when we, if we understand that we're self-made and that we're not done yet, that means that we are actually in the process of choosing what humans are going to be. And so what it needs from us is our kind of our choice and our involvement in deciding what humans want to be.
And how would we express that? In a way that the technium would affect the technium.
I tend to think of the things that we make as sort of our mind children. That's Hans Moravec's term, that they're kind of our creation, just like our children are our creation. And at some point, our children will go away, and we actually want them to be as autonomous as possible, and out of our control. And that's that's an event that we look forward to only if we have actually embedded in them or imbued them with some kind of values or guidance or some sense about how to behave as an autonomous system. And I think the same thing about our technological children. We want to actually embed in our children, our technological children, some way in which they are, as they replicate out of our control, that there's some direction that we give them. So when people are upset about the idea that the technium may have some autonomy, what I always have to emphasize is that while it has some autonomy, maybe it's 5%, 10%, the other 90% is coming from us. We're still involved in steering it. So it's not just that it's completely out of our control. It's the fact that we still have a role in it. We still will try to steer it. We still will try to help it determine what it is that we want to become. And I think that kind of co-creation is an important aspect, and that's the role that we bring. That's what technology wants from us.
Kevin Kelly, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, and I really appreciate the fantastic questions.
Kevin Kelly is a journalist and the author of What Technology Wants. You can find out more about him over on our site, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. You can also leave a comment or subscribe to our Radio Berkman Twitter feed. It's twitter.com/radioberkman. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.